Absalom, Absalom, by William Faulkner. Chapter 1. From a little after 2 o'clock until almost sundown of the long, still, hot, weary, dead September afternoon, they sat in what Miss Coldfield still called the office, because her father had called it that. A dim, hot, airless room, with the blinds all closed and fastened for 43 summers, because when she was a girl, someone had believed that light and moving air carried heat, and that dark was always cooler, and which, as the sun shone fuller and fuller on that side of the house, became latticed with yellow slashes full of dust motes, which Quentin thought of as being flecks of the dead old dried paint itself blown inward from the scaling blinds, as wind might have blown them. There was a wisteria vine blooming for the second time that summer on a wooden trellis before one window, into which sparrows came now and then in random gusts, making a dry, vivid, dusty sound before going away. And opposite Quentin, Miss Coldfield, in the eternal black, which she had worn for 43 years now, whether for sister, father, or not husband, none knew, sitting so bolt upright in the straight, hard chair that was so tall for her that her legs hung straight and rigid as if she had iron shin bones and ankles, clear of the floor with that air of impotent and static rage like children's feet, and talking in that grim, haggard, amazed voice until at last listening would renege and hearing sense self-confound, and the long-dead object of her impotent yet indomitable frustration would appear, as though by outraged recapitulation evoked, quiet, inattentive, and harmless, out of the biding and dreamy and victorious dust. Her voice would not cease, it would just vanish. There would be the dim coffin-smelling gloom, sweet and oversweet, with the twice-bloomed wisteria against the outer wall by the savage, quiet September sun impacted, distilled, and hyper-distilled, into which came now and then the loud, cloudy flutter of the sparrows, like a flat limber stick whipped by an idle boy, and the rank smell of female old flesh long embattled in virginity, while the wan, haggard face watched him above the faint triangle of lace at wrists and throat from the too tall chair in which she resembled a crucified child. And the voice not ceasing, but vanishing into and then out of the long intervals like a stream, a trickle running from patch to patch of dried sand. And the ghost mused with shadowy docility as if it were the voice which he haunted, where a more fortunate one would have had a house. Out of quiet thunderclap he would abrupt, man, horse, demon, upon a scene peaceful and decorous as a school prize watercolor, faint sulphur reek still in hair, clothes, and beard, with grouped behind him his band of wild niggers like beasts half-tamed to walk upright like men, in attitudes wild and reposed, and manacled among them the French architect with his air grim, haggard, and tataran. Immobile, bearded, and hand palm lifted, the horseman sat. Behind him the wild blacks and the captive architect huddled quietly, carrying in bloodless paradox the shovels and picks and axes of peaceful conquest. Then in the long unamaze, Quentin seemed to watch them overrun suddenly the 100 square miles of tranquil and astonished earth and drag house and formal gardens violently out of the soundless nothing, and clap them down like cards upon a table beneath the up-palm, immobile and pontific, creating the Sutphen's Hundred, the Bee Sutphen's Hundred, like the olden-time Bee Light. Then hearing would reconcile, and he would seem to listen to 2 separate Quentins now, the Quentin Compson preparing for Harvard in the South, the Deep South, dead since 1865, and peopled with garrulous, outraged, baffled ghosts, listening, having to listen, to one of the ghosts which had refused to lie still even longer than most had, telling him about old ghost times. And the Quentin Compson, who was still too young to deserve yet to be a ghost, but nevertheless having to be one for all that, since he was born and bred in the Deep South the same as she was. The 2 separate Quentins now talking to one another in the long silence of not people in not language, like this. It seems that this demon, his name was Sutphen, Colonel Sutphen, who came out of nowhere and without warning upon the land with a band of strange niggers and built a plantation, tore violently a plantation, Miss Rosa Coldfield says, tore violently, and married her sister Ellen and begot a son and a daughter which, without gentleness begot, Miss Rosa Coldfield says, without gentleness. which should have been the jewels of his pride and the shield and comfort of his old age only. Only they destroyed him or something, or he destroyed them or something, and died. And died. Without regret, Miss Rosa Coldfield says. Saved by her. Yes, saved by her. And by Quentin Compson. Yes, and by Quentin Compson. Because you are going away to attend the college at Harvard, they tell me, she said. So I don't imagine you will ever come back here and settle down as a country lawyer in a little town like Jefferson, since northern people have already seen to it that there is little left in the South for a young man. So maybe you will enter the literary profession, as so many southern gentlemen and gentlewomen, too, are doing now, and maybe some day you will remember this and write about it. You will be married then, I expect, and perhaps your wife will want a new gown or a new chair for the house, and you can write this and submit it to the magazines. Perhaps you will even remember kindly then the old woman who made you spend a whole afternoon sitting indoors and listening while she talked about people and events you were fortunate enough to escape yourself, when you wanted to be out among young friends of your own age. Yes'm, Quentin said. Only she don't mean that, he thought. It's because she wants it told. It was still early then. He had yet in his pocket the note which he had received by the hand of a small negro boy just before noon, asking him to call and see her, the quaint, stiffly formal request which was actually a summons out of another world almost. The queer, archaic sheet of ancient good notepaper written over with the neat, faded, cramped script which, due to his astonishment at the request from a woman three times his age and whom he had known all his life without having exchanged 100 words with her, or perhaps to the fact that he was only 20 years old, he did not recognize as revealing a character cold, implacable, and even ruthless. He obeyed it immediately after the noon meal, walking the half-mile between his home and hers through the dry, dusty heat of early September, and so into the house. It, too, somehow smaller than its actual size, it was of 2 stories, unpainted and a little shabby, yet with an air, a quality, of grim endurance, as though, like her, it had been created to fit into and complement a world in always a little smaller than the one in which it found itself. Where in the gloom of the shuttered hallway, whose air was even hotter than outside, as if there were prisoned in it like in a tomb all the suspiration of slow, heat-laden time which had recurred during the 43 years, the small figure in black, which did not even rustle, the wan triangle of lace at wrists and throat, the dim face looking at him with an expression speculative, urgent, and intent, waited to invite him in. It's because she wants it told, he thought, so that people whom she will never see and whose names she will never hear, and who have never heard her name nor seen her face, will read it and know at last why God let us lose the war. That only through the blood of our men and the tears of our women could he stay this demon and efface his name and lineage from the earth. Then, almost immediately, he decided that neither was this the reason why she had sent the note, and sending it, why to him? Since, if she had merely wanted it told, written, and even printed, she would not have needed to call in anybody. A woman who even in his, Quentin's, father's youth had already established, even if not affirmed, herself, as the town's and the county's poetess laureate, by issuing to the stern and meager subscription list of the county newspaper poems, ode, eulogy, and epitaph, out of some bitter and implacable reserve of undefeat. And these from a woman whose family's martial background, as both town and county knew, consisted of the father who, a conscientious objector on religious grounds, had starved to death in the attic of his own house, hidden, some said walled up, there, from Confederate Provost Marshal's men and fed secretly at night by this same daughter, who at the very time was accumulating her first folio in which the lost cause's unregenerate vanquished were named by name embalmed. And the nephew, who served for 4 years in the same company with his sister's fiancé, and then shot the fiancé to death before the gates to the house where the sister waited in her wedding gown on the eve of the wedding, and then fled, vanished, none knew where. It would be 3 hours yet before he would learn why she had sent for him, because this part of it, this first part of it, Quentin already knew. It was a part of his 20 years' heritage of breathing the same air and hearing his father talk about the man. a part of the town's, Jefferson's, 80 years heritage of the same air which the man himself had breathed between this September afternoon in 1909 and that Sunday morning in June 1833, when he first rode into town out of no discernible past and acquired his land, no one knew how, and built his house, his mansion, apparently out of nothing, and married Ellen Coldfield and begot his two children, the son who widowed the daughter who had not yet been a bride, and so accomplished his allotted course to its violent, Miss Coldfield at least would have said just, end. Quentin had grown up with that. The mere names were interchangeable and almost myriad. His childhood was full of them. His very body was an empty hall echoing with sonorous, defeated names. He was not a being, an entity. He was a commonwealth. He was a barracks filled with stubborn, back-looking ghosts, still recovering, even 43 years afterward, from the fever which had cured the disease, waking from the fever without even knowing that it had been the fever itself which they had fought against and not the sickness, looking with stubborn recalcitrance backward beyond the fever and into the disease with actual regret, weak from the fever yet free of the disease and not even aware that the freedom was that of impotence. "But why tell me about it?" he said to his father that evening, when he returned home after she had dismissed him at last with his promise to return for her in the buggy. "Why tell me about it? What is it to me that the land or the earth or whatever it was got tired of him at last and turned and destroyed him? What if it did destroy her family, too? It's going to turn and destroy us all some day, whether our name happens to be Sutphen or Coldfield or not." "Ah," Mr. Compson said, "years ago we in the South made our women into ladies. Then the war came and made the ladies into ghosts. So what else can we do, being gentlemen, but listen to them being ghosts?" Then he said, "Do you want to know the real reason why she chose you?" They were sitting on the gallery after supper, waiting for the time Miss Coldfield had set for Quentin to call for her. "It's because she will need someone to go with her, a man, a gentleman, yet one still young enough to do what she wants, do it the way she wants it done. And she chose you because your grandfather was the nearest thing to a friend which Sutphen ever had in this county. And she probably believes that Sutphen may have told your grandfather something about himself and her, about that engagement which did not engage, that troth which failed to plight. Might even have told your grandfather the reason why at the last she refused to marry him. And that your grandfather might have told me and I might have told you. And so, in a sense, the affair, no matter what happens out there tonight, will still be in the family, the skeleton, if it be a skeleton, still in the closet. She may believe that if it hadn't been for your grandfather's friendship, Sutphen could never have got a foothold here, and that if he had not got that foothold, he could not have married Ellen. So maybe she considers you partly responsible through heredity for what happened to her and her family through him." Whatever her reason for choosing him, whether it was that or not, the getting to it, Quentin thought, was taking a long time. Meanwhile, as though in inverse ratio to the vanishing voice, the invoked ghost of the man whom she could neither forgive nor revenge herself upon began to assume a quality almost of solidity, permanence. Itself circumambient and enclosed by its effluvium of hell, its aura of unregeneration, it mused. Mused thought seemed to possess sentience as if, though dispossessed of the peace, who was impervious anyhow to fatigue, which she declined to give it, it was still irrevocably outside the scope of her hurt or harm. With that quality peaceful and now harmless and not even very attentive, the ogre shape which, as Miss Coldfield's voice went on, resolved out of itself before Quentin's eyes the two half-ogre children, the three of them forming a shadowy background for the fourth one. This was the mother, the dead sister Ellen, this Niobe without tears, who had conceived to the demon in a kind of nightmare, who even while alive had moved but without life and grieved but without weeping, who now had an air of tranquil and unwitting desolation, not as if she had either outlived the others or had died first, but as if she had never lived at all. Quentin seemed to see them, the four of them arranged into the conventional family group of the period, with formal and lifeless decorum, and seen now as the fading and ancient photograph itself would have been seen, enlarged and hung on the wall behind and above the voice, and of whose presence there the voice's owner was not even aware, as if she, Miss Coldfield, had never seen this room before. A picture, a group, which even to Quentin had a quality strange, contradictory, and bizarre, not quite comprehensible, not, even to 20, quite right. A group, the last member of which had been dead 25 years and the first 50, evoked now out of the airless gloom of a dead house between an old woman's grim and implacable unforgiving and the passive chafing of a youth of 20 telling himself, even amid the voice, "Maybe you have to know anybody awful well to love them, but when you have hated somebody for 43 years you will know them awful well, so maybe it's better then, maybe it's fine then, because after 43 years they can't any longer surprise you or make you either very contented or very mad." And maybe it, the voice, the talking, the incredulous and unbearable amazement, had even been a cry aloud once, Quentin thought, long ago when she was a girl, of young and indomitable unregret, of indictment of blind circumstance and savage event. But not now. Now only the lonely, thwarted old female flesh, embattled for 43 years in the old insult, the old unforgiving, outraged and betrayed by the final and complete affront, which was Sutphen's death. "He wasn't a gentleman. He wasn't even a gentleman. He came here with a horse and 2 pistols, and a name which nobody ever heard before, knew for certain was his own, any more than the horse was his own, or even the pistols, seeking some place to hide himself, and Yoknapatawpha County supplied him with it. He sought the guarantee of reputable men to barricade him from the other and later strangers who might come seeking him in turn, and Jefferson gave him that. Then he needed respectability, the shield of a virtuous woman, to make his position impregnable even against the men who had given him protection on that inevitable day and hour when even they must rise against him in scorn and horror and outrage. And it was mine and Ellen's father who gave him that. Oh, I hold no brief for Ellen. Blind romantic fool who had only youth and inexperience to excuse her, even if that. Blind romantic fool, then later blind woman mother fool, when she no longer had either youth or inexperience to excuse her, when she lay dying in that house for which she had exchanged pride and peace both, and nobody there but the daughter who was already the same as a widow without ever having been a bride, and was 3 years later to be a widow sure enough without having been anything at all. And the son who had repudiated the very roof under which he had been born and to which he would return but once more before disappearing for good, and that as a murderer and almost a fratricide. And he, fiend, blackguard, and devil, in Virginia fightin', where the chances of the earth's being rid of him were the best anywhere under the sun, yet Ellen and I both knowin' that he would return, that every man in our armies would have to fall before bullet or ball found him. And only I, a child, mind you, 4 years younger than the very niece I was asked to save, for Ellen to turn to and say, 'Protect her, protect Judith at least.' Yes, blind romantic fool, who did not even have that 100 miles of plantation which apparently moved our father, nor that big house and the notion of slaves underfoot day and night which reconciled, I won't say moved, her aunt. No, just the face of a man who contrived somehow to swagger even on a horse. A man who so far as anyone, including the father who was to give him a daughter in marriage, knew either had no past at all or did not dare reveal it. A man who rode into town out of nowhere with a horse and 2 pistols and a herd of wild beasts that he had hunted down single-handed because he was stronger in fear than even they were in whatever heathen place he had fled from. And that French architect who looked like he had been hunted down and caught in turn by the Negroes. A man who fled here and hid, concealed himself behind respectability, behind that 100 miles of land which he took from a tribe of ignorant Indians, nobody knows how, and a house the size of a courthouse where he lived for 3 years without a window, a door, or bedstead in it, and still called it Sutphen's Hundred, as if it had been a king's grant in unbroken perpetuity from his great-grandfather. A home, position, a wife and family, which, being necessary to concealment, he accepted along with the rest of respectability, as he would have accepted the necessary discomfort and even pain of the briars and thorns in a thicket if the thicket could have given him the protection he sought. No, not even a gentleman.
Mary and Ellen or Mary and 10,000 Ellens could not have made him one. Not that he wanted to be one, or even be taken for one. No, that was not necessary, since all he would need would be Ellen's and our father's names on a wedding license, or on any other patent of respectability that people could look at and read, just as he would have wanted our father's or any other reputable man's signature on a note of hand, because our father knew who his father was in Tennessee and who his grandfather had been in Virginia. And our neighbors and the people we lived among knew that we knew, and we knew they knew we knew, and we knew that they would have believed us about who and where we came from even if we had lied, just as anyone could have looked at him once and known that he would be lying about who and where and why he came from by the very fact that apparently he had to refuse to say it all. And the very fact that he had had to choose respectability to hide behind was proof enough, if anyone needed further proof, that what he fled from must have been some opposite of respectability too dark to talk about. Because he was too young. He was just 25, and a man of 25 does not voluntarily undertake the hardship and privation of clearing virgin land and establishing a plantation in a new country just for money. Not a young man without any past that he apparently cared to discuss in Mississippi in 1833, with a river full of steamboats loaded with drunken fools covered with diamonds and bent on throwing away their cotton and slaves before the boat reached New Orleans. Not with this just one night's hard ride away, and the only handicap or obstacle being the other blackguards, or the risk of being put ashore on a sandbar, and at the remotest a hemp rope. And he was no younger son sent out from some old quiet country like Virginia or Carolina, with the surplus negroes to take up new land, because anyone could look at those negroes of his and tell that they may have come, and probably did, from a much older country than Virginia or Carolina, but it wasn't a quiet one. And anyone could have looked once at his face and known that he would have chosen the river, and even the certainty of the hemp rope, to undertake what he undertook, even if he had known that he would find gold buried and waiting for him in the very land which he had bought. No, I hold no more brief for Ellen than I do for myself. I hold even less for myself, because I had had 20 years in which to watch him, where Ellen had had but 5, and not even those 5 to see him, but only to hear at second hand what he was doing, and not even to hear more than half of that, since apparently half of what he actually did during those 5 years nobody at all knew about, and half of the remainder no man would have repeated to a wife, let alone a young girl. He came here and set up a raree show which lasted 5 years, and Jefferson paid him for the entertainment by at least shielding him to the extent of not telling their women folks what he was doing. But I had had all my life to watch him in, since apparently, and for what reason heaven has not seen fit to divulge, my life was destined to end on an afternoon in April 43 years ago. Since anyone who even had as little to call livin' as I had had up to that time would not call what I have had since livin'. I saw what had happened to Ellen, my sister. I saw her almost a recluse, watching those 2 doomed children growing up whom she was helpless to save. I saw the price which she had paid for that house and that pride. I saw the notes of hand on pride and contentment and peace and all to which she had put her signature when she walked into the church that night begin to fall due in succession. I saw Judith's marriage forbidden without rhyme or reason or shadow of excuse. I saw Ellen die with only me, a child, to turn to and ask to protect her remaining child. I saw Henry repudiate his home and birthright, and then return and practically fling the bloody corpse of his sister's sweetheart at the hem of her wedding gown. I saw that man return, the evil source and head which had outlasted all its victims, who had created 2 children not only to destroy one another and his own line, but my line as well. Yet I agreed to marry him. No, I hold no brief for myself. I don't plead youth, since what creature in the South since 1861, man, woman, nigger, or mule, had had time or opportunity not only to have been young, but to have heard what being young was like from those who had. I don't plead propinquity, the fact that I, a woman young and at the age for Marion, and in a time when most of the young men whom I would have known ordinarily were dead on lost battlefields, that I lived for 2 years under the same roof with him. I don't plead material necessity. The fact that, an orphan, a woman, and a pauper, I turned naturally not for protection but for actual food to my only kin, my dead sister's family. Though I defy anyone to blame me, an orphan of 20, a young woman without resources, who should desire not only to justify her situation but to vindicate the honor of a family, the good name of whose women has never been impugned, by accepting the honorable proffer of marriage from the man whose food she was forced to subsist on. And most of all, I do not plead myself. A young woman emerging from a holocaust which had taken parents, security, and all from her, who had seen all that living meant to her fall into ruins about the feet of a few figures with the shapes of men, but with the names and statures of heroes. A young woman, I say, thrown into daily and hourly contact with one of these men who, despite what he might have been at one time, and despite what she might have believed or even known about him, had fought for 4 honorable years for the soil and traditions of the land where she had been born. And the man who had done that, villain died though he be, would have possessed in her eyes, even if only from association with them, the stature and shape of a hero too. And now he also emerging from the same holocaust in which she had suffered, with nothing to face what the future held for the South but his bare hands and the sword which he at least had never surrendered, and the citation for valor from his defeated commander-in-chief. Oh, he was brave. I have never gainsaid that. But that our cause, our very life and future hopes and past pride, should have been thrown into the balance with men like that to buttress it, men with valor and strength but without pity or honor. Is it any wonder that heaven saw fit to let us lose?
Nome, Quentin said.
But that it should have been our father, mine and Ellen's father, of all of them that he knew, out of all the ones who used to go out there and drink and gamble with him and watch him fight those wild negroes, whose daughters he might even have won at cards, that it should have been our father. How he could have approached Papa, on what grounds? What there could have been beside the common civility of 2 men meeting on the street, between a man who came from nowhere or dared not to tell where, and our father? What there could have been between a man like that and Papa, a Methodist steward, a merchant who was not rich and who not only could have done nothing under the sun to advance his fortunes or prospects, but could by no stretch of the imagination even have owned anything that he would have wanted, even picked up in the road? A man who owned neither land nor slaves except 2 house servants, whom he had freed as soon as he got them, bought them, who neither drank nor hunted nor gambled. What there could have been between Papa and a man who, to my certain knowledge, was never in a Jefferson church but 3 times in his life, the once when he first saw Ellen, the once when they rehearsed the wedding, the once when they performed it. A man that anyone could look at and see that, even if he apparently had none now, he was accustomed to having money and intended to have it again and would have no scruples about how he got it. That man to discover Ellen inside a church. In church, mind you. As though there were a fatality and curse on our family, and God himself was seeing to it that it was performed and discharged to the last drop and dreg. Yes, fatality and curse on the South and on our family, as though because some ancestor of ours had elected to establish his descent in a land primed for fatality and already cursed with it, even if it had not rather been our family, our father's progenitors who had incurred the curse long years before and had been coerced by heaven into establishing itself in the land and the time already cursed. So that even I, a child, still too young to know more than that, though Ellen was my own sister and Henry and Judith my own nephew and niece, I was not even to go out there, save when Papa or my aunt was with me, and that I was not to play with Henry and Judith at all except in the house. And not because I was 4 years younger than Judith and 6 years younger than Henry, wasn't it to me that Ellen turned before she died and said, "Protect them"? Even I used to wonder what our father or his father could have done before he married our mother, that Ellen and I would have to expiate, and neither of us alone be sufficient. What crime committed that would leave our family cursed to be instruments not only for that man's destruction, but for our own?"
"Yes'm," Quentin said.
"Yes," the grim, quiet voice said from beyond the unmoving triangle of dim lace. And now, among the musing and decorous wraiths, Quentin seemed to watch resolving the figure of a little girl, in prim skirts and pantalettes, the smooth, prim, decorous braids of the dead time. She seemed to stand, to lurk, behind the neat picket fence of a small, grimly middle-class yard or lawn, looking out upon the whatever ogre world of that quiet village street, with that air of children born too late into their parents' lives and doomed to contemplate all human behavior through the complex and needless follies of adults. An air Cassandra-like and humorless and profoundly and sternly prophetic out of all proportion to the actual years even of a child who had never been young.
"Because I was born too late. I was born 22 years too late. A child to whom out of the overheard talk of adults my own sisters and my sisters' children's faces had come to be like the faces in an ogre tale between supper and bed, long before I was old enough or big enough to be permitted to play with them. Yet to whom that sister must have to turn at last when she lay dying, with one of the children vanished and doomed to be a murderer, and the other doomed to be a widow before she had even been a bride, and say, 'Protect her, at least. At least save Judith.' A child, yet whose child's vouchsafed instinct could make that reply which the mature wisdom of her elders apparently could not make. 'Protect her? From whom and from what? He has already given them life. He does not need to harm them further. It is from themselves that they need protection.'"
It should have been later than it was. It should have been late, yet the yellow slashes of mote palpitant sunlight were latticed no higher up the impalpable wall of gloom which separated them. The sun seemed hardly to have moved. It, the talking, the telling, seemed, to him, to Quentin, to partake of that logic and reason-flouting quality of a dream which the sleeper knows must have occurred, stillborn and complete, in a second. Yet the very quality upon which it must depend to move the dreamer, verisimilitude, to credulity, horror or pleasure or amazement, depends as completely upon a formal recognition of and acceptance of elapsed and yet elapsing time as music or a printed tale.
"Yes, I was born too late. I was a child who was to remember those three faces, and his too, as seen for the first time in the carriage on that first Sunday morning when this town finally realized that he had turned that road from Sutphen's Hundred into the church, into a racetrack. I was three then, and doubtless I had seen them before, I must have. But I do not remember it. I do not even remember ever having seen Ellen before that Sunday. It was as though the sister whom I had never laid eyes on, who before I was born had vanished into the stronghold of an ogre or a djinn, was now to return through a dispensation of one day only to the world which she had quitted. And I, a child of three, waked early for the occasion, dressed and curled as if for Christmas, for an occasion more serious than Christmas even, since now and at last this ogre or djinn had agreed for the sake of the wife and the children to come to church, to permit them at least to approach the vicinity of salvation, to at least give Ellen one chance to struggle with him for those children's souls on a battleground where she could be supported not only by heaven but by her own family and people of her own kind. Yes, even for the moment submitting himself to redemption, or lacking that, at least chivalrous for the instant, even though still unregenerate. That is what I expected. This is what I saw, as I stood there before the church between Papa and our aunt and waited for the carriage to arrive from the 12-mile drive. And though I must have seen Ellen and the children before this, this is the vision of my first sight of them which I shall carry to my grave. A glimpse like the forefront of a tornado, of the carriage and Ellen's high white face within it, and the two replicas of his face in miniature flanking her. And on the front seat the face and teeth of the wild negro who was driving. And he, his face exactly like the negro's, save for the teeth, this because of his beard doubtless, all in a thunder and a fury of wild-eyed horses and of galloping and of dust. Oh, there were plenty of them to abet him, assist him, make a race of it. 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, the carriage racing on 2 wheels up to the very door to the church with that wild negro in his Christian clothes looking exactly like a performing tiger in a linen duster and a top hat. And Ellen, with no drop of blood in her face, holding those 2 children who were not crying and who did not need to be held, who sat on either side of her perfectly still too, with in their faces that infantile enormity which we did not then quite comprehend. Oh, yes, there were plenty to aid and abet him. Even he could not have held a horse race without someone to race against. Because it was not even public opinion that stopped him, not even the men who might have had wives and children in carriages to be ridden down and into ditches. It was the minister himself, speaking in the name of the women of Jefferson and Yoknapatawpha County. So he quit coming to church himself. Now it would be just Ellen and the children in the carriage on Sunday morning. So we knew now that at least there would be no betting now, since no one could say if it was an actual race or not, since now, with his face absent, it was only the wild negro's perfectly inscrutable one with the teeth glinting a little, so that now we could never know if it were a race or a runaway, and if there was triumph it was on the face 12 miles back there at Sutpen's Hundred, which did not even require to see or be present. It was the negro now, who in the act of passing another carriage spoke to that team too, as well as to his own. Something without words, not needin' words, probably, in that tongue in which they slept in the mud of that swamp and brought here out of whatever dark swamp he had found them in and brought them here. The dust, the thunder, the carriage whirling up to the church door while women and children scattered and screamed before it and men caught at the bridles of the other team. And the negro would let Ellen and the children out at the door, and take the carriage on around to the Hitchin Grove and beat the horses for running away. There was even a fool who tried to interfere once, whereupon the negro turned upon him with the stick lifted and his teeth showing a little, and said, "Master say, I do. You tell master." Yes, from them, from themselves. And this time it was not even the minister. It was Ellen. Our aunt and papa were talking, and I came in and my aunt said, "Go out and play," though even if I could not have heard through the door at all, I could have repeated the conversation for them. "Your daughter, your own daughter," my aunt said. And papa, "Yes, she is my daughter. When she wants me to interfere, she will tell me so herself." Because this Sunday, when Ellen and the children came out of the front door, it was not the carriage waitin', it was Ellen's phaeton with the old gentle mare which she drove and the stable boy that he had bought instead of the wild negro. And Judith looked once at the phaeton and realized what it meant and began to scream, screamin' and kickin' while they carried her back into the house and put her to bed. No, he was not present, nor do I claim a lurkin' triumphant face behind a window curtain. Probably he would have been as amazed as we were, since we would all realize now that we were faced by more than a child's tantrum or even hysteria. That his face had been in that carriage all the time, that it had been Judith, a girl of 6, who had instigated and authorized that negro to make the team run away. Not Henry, mind, not the boy, which would have been outrageous enough, but Judith, the girl. As soon as Papa and I entered those gates that afternoon and began to go up the drive toward the house, I could feel it. It was as though somewhere in that Sunday afternoon's quiet and peace, the screams of that child still existed, lingered, not as sound now, but as something for the skin to hear, the hair on the head to hear. But I did not ask at once. I was just 4 then. I sat in the buggy beside Papa as I had stood between him and our aunt before the church on that first Sunday when I'd been dressed to come and see my sister and my nephew and niece for the first time, looking at the house. I had been inside it before too, of course, but even when I saw it for the first time that I could remember, I seemed already to know how it was going to look, just as I seemed to know how Ellen and Judith and Henry would look before I saw them for the time which I always remember as being the first. No, not asking even then, but just looking at that huge, quiet house, saying, "What room is Judith sick in, Papa?" with that quiet aptitude of a child for accepting the inexplicable, though I now know that even then I was wondering what Judith saw when she came out the door and found the phaeton instead of the carriage, the tame stable boy instead of the wild man. What she had seen in that phaeton which looked so innocent to the rest of us, or worse, what she had missed when she saw the phaeton and began to scream. Yes, a still, hot, quiet Sunday afternoon like this afternoon. I remember yet the utter quiet of that house when we went in, and from which I knew at once that he was absent, without knowing that he would now be in the Scuppernong Arbor drinking with Wash Jones. I only knew, as soon as Papa and I crossed the threshold, that he was not there. As though with some almost omniscient conviction, that same instinctive knowledge which enabled me to tell Ellen that it was not from him that Judith would need protection, knowing that he did not need to stay and observe his triumph, and that in comparison with what was to be, this one was a mere trivial business even beneath our notice, too. Yes, that quiet, darkened room with the blinds closed and a negro woman sitting beside the bed with a fan and Judith's white face on the pillow beneath a camphor cloth, asleep as I supposed then, possibly it was sleep or would be called sleep. And Ellen's face white and calm, and Papa said, "Go out and find Henry and ask him to play with you, Rosa." And so I stood just outside that quiet door in that quiet upper hall because I was afraid to go away even from it, because I could hear the Sabbath afternoon quiet of that house louder than thunder, louder than laughing even with triumph. "Think of the children," Papa said. "Think," Ellen said, "what else do I do? What else do I lie awake at night and do but think of them?" Neither Papa nor Ellen said, "Come back home." No, this occurred before it became fashionable to repair your mistakes by turning your back on them and running. It was just the two quiet voices beyond that blank door which might have been discussing something printed in a magazine. And I, a child, standing close beside that door because I was afraid to be there but more afraid to leave it, standing motionless beside that door as though trying to make myself blend with the dark wood and become invisible, like a chameleon, listening to the living spirit, presence of that house, since some of Ellen's life and breath had now gone into it as well as his, breathing away in a long neutral sound of victory and despair, of triumph and terror too. "Do you love this?" Papa said. "Papa," Ellen said. That was all, but I could see her face then as clearly as Papa could have, with that same expression which it had worn in the carriage on that first Sunday and the others. Then a servant came and said our buggy was ready. Yes, from themselves. Not from him, not from anybody, just as nobody could have saved them, even himself. Because he now showed us why that triumph had been beneath his notice. He showed Ellen, that is, not I. I was not there. It was 6 years now, during which I had scarcely seen him. Our aunt was gone now, and I was keeping house for Papa. Perhaps once a year Papa and I would go out there and have dinner, and maybe 4 times a year Ellen and the children would come in and spend the day with us. Not he. That I know of, he never entered this house again after he and Ellen married. I was young then. I was even young enough to believe that this was due to some stubborn coal of conscience, if not remorse, even in him. But I know better now. I know now that it was simply because since Papa had given him respectability through a wife, there was nothing else he could want from Papa. And so not even sheer gratitude, let alone appearances, could force him to forego his own pleasure to the extent of taking a family meal with his wife's people. So I saw little of them. I did not have time now to play, even if I had ever had any inclination. I had never learned how, and I saw no reason to try to learn now, even if I had had the time. So it was 6 years now, though it was actually no secret to Ellen, since it had apparently been going on ever since he drove the last nail in the house, the only difference between now and the time of his bachelorhood being that now they would hitch the teams and saddle horses and mules in the grove beyond the stable, and so come up across the pasture unseen from the house. Because there were plenty of them still. It was as if God or the devil had taken advantage of his very vices in order to supply witnesses to the discharge of our curse, not only from among gentlefolks, our own kind, but from the very scum and riffraff who could not have approached the house itself under any other circumstances, not even from the rear. Yes,
Ellen and those two children alone in that house 12 miles from town, and down there in the stable a hollow square of faces in the lantern light. The white faces on three sides, the black ones on the fourth, and in the center two of his wild negroes fighting, naked, fighting not like white men fight with rules and weapons, but like negroes fight to hurt one another quick and bad. Ellen knew that, or thought she did. That was not it. She accepted that. Not reconciled, accepted. As though there is a breathing point in outrage where you can accept it almost with gratitude, since you can say to yourself, "Thank God this is all. At least I now know all of it." Thinking that, clinging still to that, when she ran into the stable that night while the very men who had stolen into it from the rear fell back away from her with at least some grain of decency, and Ellen seeing not the two black beasts she had expected to see, but instead a white one and a black one, both naked to the waist and gouging at one another's eyes as if their skins should not only have been the same color but should have been covered with fur, too. Yes, it seems that on certain occasions, perhaps at the end of the evening, the spectacle, as a grand finale or perhaps as a matter of sheer deadly forethought toward the retention of supremacy, domination, he would enter the ring with one of the negroes himself. Yes, that is what Ellen saw. Her husband and the father of her children standing there naked and panting and bloody to the waist, and the negro just fallen evidently, lying at his feet and bloody too, save that on the negro it merely looked like grease or sweat. Ellen running down the hill from the house, bareheaded, in time to hear the sound, the screaming, hearing it while she still ran in the darkness and before the spectators knew that she was there, hearing it even before it occurred to one spectator to say, "It's a horse," then "It's a woman," then "My God, it's a child," ran in, and the spectators fallen back to permit her to see Henry plunge out from among the negroes who had been holding him, screaming and vomiting. Not pausing, not even looking at the faces which shrank back away from her as she knelt in the stable filth to raise Henry, and not looking at Henry either but up at him, as he stood there with even his teeth showing beneath his beard now, and another negro wiping the blood from his body with a toe sack. "I know you will excuse us, gentlemen," Ellen said. But they were already departing, nigger and white, slinking out again as they had slunk in, and Ellen not watching them now either, but kneeling in the dirt while Henry clung to her, crying, and he standing there yet while a third nigger prodded his shirt or coat at him as though the coat were a stick and he a caged snake. "Where is Judith, Thomas?" Ellen said. "Judith?" he said. "Oh, he was not lying. His own triumph had outrun him. He had builded even better in evil than even he could have hoped." "Judith, isn't she in bed?" "Don't lie to me, Thomas," Ellen said. "I can understand your bringing Henry here to see this, wanting Henry to see this. I will try to understand it. Yes, I will make myself try to understand it. But not Judith, Thomas. Not my baby girl, Thomas." "I don't expect you to understand it," he said, "because you are a woman. But I didn't bring Judith down here. I would not bring her down here. I don't expect you to believe that, but I swear to it." "I wish I could believe you," Ellen said. "I want to believe you." Then she began to call. "Judith," she called in a voice calm and sweet and filled with despair. "Judith, honey, time to come to bed." But I was not there. I was not there to see the two Sutpen faces this time, once on Judith and once on the negro girl beside her, looking down through the square entrance to the loft.